The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, friends, we're moving right along here, and we're now going to start the third section in the outline. We've looked at worldview very, very briefly. We've seen some of the basic principles. Now we want to spend a little time showing how this works with or explains or interfaces with the contemporary world. And I'll be arguing here that Christian apologetics, at its best, ought to be using different tools for understanding the times, which will lead to much more sympathetic conversations. And I'll line this out systematically a little bit later. But let me say here that any legitimate kind of study of the contemporary situation can be helpful in speaking to people. Sometimes, whether those people have personal contact with a special discipline or not. One of the places that you can go to understand our times and even to do evangelism, surprisingly perhaps, is the art galleries. Now, if somebody could turn off one or two of the lights enough so that you could still see if you want to take notes. Actually, yeah. What would you like? Okay, Zach, can you all see this? All right. I want to take a brief journey into modern art, how we got here. This will be very simple. Not to entice any of us to become art experts, but in order to show one of the ways in which we have a window on contemporary culture. It could be in science, in music, in psychology, in pop culture, in observations of the way people do philosophy. There are lots of ways of tracking what's going on, surveys, all the rest of it. But one of my favorite ways to try to track what's going on is to look at the folks who have visualized their spiritual struggles. Now, I don't know how well you can see this. Anybody comment on this particular painting? What?
Looks kind of brown.
Kind of brown. All right.
I don't like
Let's take it seriously. But is it art? Okay. Let's get all that off the table. Let's talk about the painting. Maybe could you turn off one more light just for the moment? Because it's kind of hard to see. Yeah, the other one would be... All right. Now it makes sense. Now we understand it. Now we love it.
Which part is the painting? Is it just the part on the left?
It's just the part on the left. It has a frame, a suggestion of a frame in outside of the black part. Just talk about the painting. Not sort of I like it or don't like it. I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's only a painting, but.
Like a reservoir, a water reservoir.
Okay. The blue thing down there certainly could remind you of water, yeah, uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting statement. It looks, if your eye is drawn upward, and I think that's accurate. Let me tell you a little bit about this. in the wake of the Second World War, really the center for art moved from Paris to New York. Several painters, many of them Jewish, it happens, found that they wanted to make a complete break with the past, a sort of tabula rasa. And they moved into something that was even less representational than some of the previous work, deliberately having things like untitled in their title, or deliberately making these very abstract units. Now, the style here is known as abstract expressionism. And Mark Rothko was one of the leading figures in this whole movement. It's large because it's American. Everything in America was big to these Europeans who came over. And yet, there's something intimate and human. You're drawn into it. There's a, if you look at this long enough, you begin, your eye begins to move from one part to the other. You begin to sense that this has an almost religious meaning. Rothko, in 1943, declared, "The subject is crucial, and only that subject matter is valid, which is tragic and timeless." Okay, you don't find anything that looks like this on the streets or in the real world, but you do find it in a timeless zone. It's pre-literate. It's almost primitive because it's in our heads. And in much of Rothko's work, you have this movement from the beach to the sky as a ritual. He was a Russian who thought that art should carry a full religious meaning, but without referring to the traditional religious subjects. Now, let's see how it got to this place. What's going on? In the same basic year, or maybe a year later, this painting was produced. Now, probably a lot of us know who the painter is. What do you see here? Chaos? Is there anything besides chaos? I mean, is there any order here at all? Yeah, that black is pretty close to the center. That may or may not be a central focus. You can't see it very well in this reproduction, but he,
sure if it was delivered.
Yeah, he actually threw some paint on the canvas at that point and let it run down, whereas the rest of it is not with that same technique. So it probably does have a central reality.
It almost looks like there is,
Okay. There's the order of scribbling, huh? Or something.
Yellow is like little points of light.
Yeah.
Over all the points of light, the black.
That's a good point. And he entitled this Yellow Islands. Art has moved from the open Mediterranean to New York City, and from Matisse to people like Jackson Pollock. Pollock was deeply affected by a couple of the leaders in the 20s and 30s, especially Kandinsky. And he saw the universe as having basic rhythms, but they weren't easily decipherable. And he tried, again, to draw you into the basic rhythms of the universe by making you see the unity and diversity in what is an apparently chaotic world. It's called the all-over method. Not as in it's all over, but as in all over the canvas. He got this from taking totems and loosening them up. This style may be the most significant innovation since Cubism in 1911. And it has a decorative side, but it also has this grand exploration side, drawing you into something immense. It's Wagnerian. Somebody once called it a vast something. Now, how did art get to this place? And, you know, we still, it's interesting, we still talk about modern art, even though there's been modern art since the early 20th century. That was 100 years ago. And people still go to museums and they look at this stuff and they say, I don't like it. At the most shocking of 19th century art, it only took a few years or decades for people to say, oh, I see, I understand. I mean, the Impressionists had a hard time getting started. And then now it's one of the favorite art forms. This still isn't accepted. What happened? Well, let's go back in time. Any notion of what this might be? You've got various clues. But before you tell me what it is, tell me about the style. Tell me about the way the painting is organized. Yeah, divide and sector is it's a collage of different things. And they're clearly divided, but they're very much a collage. Is there any order to the division? Yeah, it's symmetrical. It goes also from left to right. The stuff on the left and the stuff on top is more acceptable, sacred, holy, whereas on the right and in the bottom, you have people going down into eternal suffering. It's obviously a very pedagogical painting. What sorts of things might be instructed in this painting? Yeah, it might be as simple as that. I think that could be right. It's your options are before you in this book. And it's not the Bible. Does anyone have any idea who this figure might be? Yeah, it's Dante, good for you. Because you see him up there with Beatrice at the top of the Paradiso. And then you have the Purgatorio and then down to the depths of hell, the Inferno. And now you're between, and Dante's showing us this universe. And the church is the place where you need to go to discover the better way. Now, it's a very rich painting. Obviously, it was done in about the 15th or early 16th century, and it was about, in a visual form, it says what the theology is. Okay, the world is divided into three major spheres, paradise, purgatory, and hell. And the man who sees it and instructs you is the man of the book, it's Dante. And he's, of course, not in this picture. His feet look like they're kind of off the ground, and he's posted on there. Now, what a different universe, isn't it, in a way, from the Rothko and the Pollock? It's religious, like they want to be, but it's about a very clear theology, very clearly depicted. As you move into later generations, you come to perhaps what might be the deepest, most profound expression of Christian faith. Now, let's first talk about the difference. What is this painting? What does this painting carry that the Dante one doesn't seem to have? Or the other way around, what doesn't it have that Dante did have? Say it again.
Realistic.
Yeah, it's much more realistic. This is a credible scene, almost. I mean, there weren't that type of tower, perhaps, in biblical times, but it's much more realistic. These are people. Okay, what else?
Suggestive.
Yeah, that's very good. Suggestive based on shading and light. Hold that thought, because that's a very important clue to what's happening here. Right. It's not iconic in the sense that the Dante was. Here's Dante, he's got his book. Here's what's going to happen to you if you don't read the book and go to church. if there's any such message in here, it's very, very subtle. It's through the personalities, through the light. Of course, who painted this? Yeah. Say it loud. You're right. Rembrandt was a 17th century painter in Holland. He had an upbringing with the Bible. He was in a Reformed culture. In 1642, tragically, his wife Saskia died, but his painting suddenly became, I don't know what other word to use, but truly incarnational. You don't feel there's a moral oppression here of, look, you've got a lesson, and I want you to learn it. But there are lessons to learn. You have Jesus, who by the lighting is more obscure than the woman, but who in the light is obviously the central figure, and by the expression on his face. And this is a work of complete genius, but it also could not have occurred had Rembrandt not, I believe, been profoundly imbued with the gospel. And in his later years, he painted the road to Emmaus over and over again, and he deliberately took the halos off Jesus and took the dramatic signs away and made the truth of it very personal, psychological, inward, which is really what the incarnation is all about. It's not, Jesus didn't, he wasn't like a magician or a Superman or something like that. He was truly man as well as truly God. This is, I think, a high point in Christian consciousness of the world. You could look at this for days and weeks and you just scratch the surface. What is he saying to her? What's the expression on her face? Is she registering? Is she accepting? Is she hesitating? I know this is a reproduction that's actually pretty good. The painting itself is about this dark. We now move up to the 19th century. We have a continuity and a discontinuity with what we saw before. What would be the continuity? The lights in the background, yeah. People are real. It's very realistic. What are the continuities? You can't see it very well, and you can't see it in the original very well either, but can you detect anything on the expression of the woman and the child? What kind of woman is she? Yeah, it's a laundry case of some sort. She's a working woman. Same sort of woman, no doubt, as the Samaritan woman. Discontinuities. It's very dark. And
focus of the light is on the background.
Yeah. And Jesus isn't there giving meaning to it. Or not that you have to picture him to be a Christian painter, but there's a kind of, I wouldn't say meaninglessness, but it's a slice of lifeness that doesn't have a whole lot of significance, either hopeful or not hopeful. She's bent over. You might say, oh, gosh, maybe she's going through a hard time. But she's climbing the stairs. I mean, it's there. And by the 19th century, this was a bold move. Painters as well as authors, novelists, were painting and writing about a slice of life. Instead of heroes, heroines, mythic figures, biblical figures, you have just working people. And you have what sociologists call the beginnings of secularization. You keep the realistic part, but the meaning part begins to be less and less apparent. So bold was the move towards realism that artists began to question whether the scene out there was really there and therefore could be reproduced on a canvas, or whether it was just my eye that caught various parts. Now, I've given some of this away by saying that, but just look at that. This painting. This is a very crucial move in the history of art in the West. What characteristics of this painting can you see that, you know, strike you immediately that are quite different from anything that's come before? Right, it's anonymous. The faces, you can't make them out. Okay, good. What else? Yeah, it's got a, it's fuzzy, isn't it, in a way? I mean, it's, actually, it's not, if you look at it, the details are amazing, but it, the result is a kind of impressionistic result. Yes, indeed. What about the light? A lot of little bits of light peering through. There's the guy's trousers, there's this scarf hanging down on the banister, there's the light reflecting in the water. We're so used to this, and we love this style, but this was a huge shock in those days because you wouldn't have thought to give equal attention to small points of light as you would to faces or clothes. Or, and it's not just a slice of life, it's a slice of reality. It's almost like, take a picture, and this is what you would get, except you couldn't, because it's very artistic. There's the tree in the middle. There's all kinds of artistic things that are very deliberate. Who painted this? La Grenouillère was a place just on the Seine outside of Paris where the Parisians like to go and have some entertainment and so forth. So much did the Impressionists, as they began to call themselves, trust that the impression of the light on their retina was as real, if not more so, than the conventional pictures of reality would have given us to believe, that you almost feel like, well, two things are going on. One is you're seeing in a new way for the first time. And that's why I think everyone loves this style. It's just, it's sensuous, it's powerful, it's got colors, it brings out these things. At the same time, reality seems to be slipping away. It's hard to focus here. There's a painting that he did called Impressions Sunrise, from which the movement got its name, and endless interesting stuff about the Impressionists. They were rejected by the academic painters, and as you may know the story, they decided they had to paint in their own show, which was kind of off the mainstream. And the reviews they got were terrible. People said they just threw paint on the canvas. They had broad brush strokes because they were too lazy to paint in a refined way. But as I say, it didn't take 10 or 15 years before this became the mainstream, because the academic art, and I guess I should have put one of those in here just for you to see, was so rigid and cold and accurate and detailed that it lacked humanity. So you have this interesting turning point in art. In one place that I've written about, I like to compare it to the man born blind whose eyes were opened and he saw the world for the first time. And then the Pharisees criticize him, and although they've been able to see all along, they're really the blind people. And Impressionist art was moving in that direction, but then because of secularization, because it didn't have a Christian framework really to rest on, all they had was the impression of light on the retina. Cézanne said of Monet, "He's only an eye, but what an eye." Speaking of Cézanne. Now, I don't want to be an evolutionist here. I don't believe that art takes a monolithic journey. And I certainly don't think it takes a monolithic journey downhill. I think you'll find in the best of contemporary art two simultaneous trends. The one is, indeed, that you lose the reality because you're seeing for the first time. But the other is that you're still looking for meaning. You're still, and some are Christians who have the meaning, Some are just looking. Now, this is a wonderful example of this double-edged nature of art. What do you see here? It's a mountain, and it is in France. Yeah, very good. What do you see structurally? What do you see in terms of the body, the composition, the volume, the colors? Okay, because in what way? I agree. Right. It's not fully cubist yet, but look at how the angles are almost like geometric figures rather than, you know, really the way rocks look. And he does that with the colors, emphasizing what unifies very disparate parts of the scene through color and through angles. And that mountain, it actually looks that way. We lived in that part of France for some 11 years, and it sure is a strange thing to look at. It juts up, it's granite, and it's called the Sainte Victoire, the Saint Victory. And every this Cézanne, he always moved from that ground level to the victory of heaven, and wanted his paintings to help you to see the structure of the creation, the structure of reality, but also to ask, where is it going? Why am I on the right road? Is it leading to victory? Again, this is an amazing transition figure. He was, he's sometimes called a post-impressionist. I don't know about these labels. If I were an artist, I wouldn't want to be post anything. I'd want to be me. But, you know, he comes after the big flurry of impressionism, and he does move it in a direction that you were suggesting is going to lead to what we call cubism. But, I mean, this is, he's still holding it all together here. And then something strange begins to happen. This is one of the most famous paintings of all time. And it was done in a year, which is one of the most notorious years of all time for art history and world history and so forth. What do you see here? How do you know they're prostitutes? Okay, yeah, that's good. Because, I mean, you don't want to just say prostitutes because they're nude, but their poses are meant to be seductive, and being together, which is the way in big cities often prostitution works. But what else about them? It's a very strange group of women. Okay.
He's not trying to make it more real.
Yeah, there's something, I agree, there's something strangely grotesque about it. What has he done to the faces to emphasize that? I'll tell you why it's a bold step in a minute when you've thought about that question. What do the faces have in common? Particularly the one in the middle. Uh-huh. He took this, he was going through a stage that we now call primitivism. He was intrigued by the art of Africa. He had a collection of African masks. And so he caricatured the women's faces with features of an African mask, partly to make it anonymous, which is what a prostitute often is. It's a woman who is an object. Partly, though, again, we have this challenging of the older view. Things aren't so secure in this world anymore. We're seeing things for the first time. I mean, painting a prostitute, that's just, you're not supposed to do that. Painting women who are looking seductive, but almost absurdly so. This actually is considered one of the paintings of about half a dozen that propelled art into a radical type of modernity. Young ladies is a okay translation. It's demoiselle, which means the misses. And that's a very ironic title. It would be like saying the German Mädchen or maiden, the maidens of Avignon. It was in a city that actually is a fairly industrial city, still a fair amount of prostitution there. But to actually make a statement about that and call them young ladies, it was an in-your-face move. And eventually it led to things like this. Somebody mentioned cubism. Why go this way? What is going on? What happened to trees and lakes and heroes and reality is being reduced to shape and form and color, absolutely. Although in this artist's mind, it was a way to show the greatness of reality. He would have said, reality is expanded by my showing you a few of its most salient features. Now, there's still a subject here. We're not yet at Pollock or Rothko. What can anybody discern what the subject is? It's almost like, you need new glasses, you've got, or it's a kaleidoscope. Is it a woman? Almost. It's the other kind. But in a way, one of the things that does kind of disappear or become ambiguous with this style is gender differences. Now, where's the violin? Can you see? This is like, where's Waldo, you know? Find Waldo. It's there. I mean, it's suggested. And if those of you in the back of the classroom may not be able to see this too clearly, but you've got the little openings that you have in typical violins, a suggested one there, a suggested one here. Got a couple of other places where the violin is protruding in the complex. Got this place here. Almost clues rather than anything about a violin. And the face, it's a dual face. So sometimes he would do three or four angles at once. Why would you paint sort of a broken up reality of one thing or a mobile-like look at reality from multiple points of view? This is like multi-perspectivalism big time. Why? I think yes and no. I think he's certainly the effect of this is to break up one's ordinary security that there's one way to look at things and to be true. And that can easily lead to sort of relativism, multi-perspectivalism. But at the same time, he thought he was finding something more basic, more fundamental, behind the veil of what we see. There is a unity of what we don't see, but it's manifest, it's suggested. It's almost a God-like perspective. And Hans Ruckmacher, in his book, Modern Art and the Death of a Culture, I think very powerfully shows that in questioning visible reality, it wasn't just saying there's nothing, but it's saying that if we're going to find what the thing is, we're going to have to go beyond to a more fundamental, basic, invisible level. And on it goes. This one is our homegrown artist. Well, not homegrown, but lived here more than any other place in his life. This is another big step leading towards modern art. Anybody comment on this? Down the stairs. Yes, there are stairs there. And what is going down the stairs? Sorry? I didn't hear. It's a person, yeah? What kind of person? A nude person. Now here, the idea, I mean, in Picasso, it was to show different facets at the same time, and he was always fascinated with music and faces and so on. This is showing how motion works. In reality, like Zeno's paradox, if you don't have a Christian meaning structure, motion is just a whole lot of small steps joined together by us. But is there an ur motion or a deep motion? And how do we know she's nude? You almost don't until you see the title. And then you try to see it, And in trying to see it, you think, wait a minute, what am I looking at? And so it's one of these. He was a Frenchman who lived most of his life in Philadelphia. If you want to, Philadelphia Art Museum has the greatest Duchamp collection in the world. And he was a fascinating man. He wasn't just a rebel against everything, although he did some very weird stuff. But he was in this same quest. Question what I see, because behind what I see may be divinity, may be truth, may be that meaning I've been looking for. Various ways to do this, various attempts to do this. Remember I told you that Rothko was influenced by Kandinsky? Kandinsky, these are all these amazing years just before the First World War, when artists were beginning to go in a whole lot of directions on this quest. Kandinsky had become convinced, and all the, by the way, this isn't just nonsense. All these guys could paint, they went to art school. If you look at the early stages of Kandinsky, he's a genius draftsman of realistic art. So he's not just making fun of his audience. This is serious stuff. Kandinsky had come to the conclusion that there was a reality behind reality, and it was called the spiritual. And he wrote a seminal essay called On the Spiritual in Art. And it has been a book that has influenced generations of artists. And like these predecessors, he believed that in order to see the spiritual, we've got to have our minds messed with. We've got to look and travel from one bizarre image to another. Now there's some suggestions of real things in here. It's not completely non-objective. But it's the tanglements, it's the confusions, it's the dreams of the mind. Now, on this quest for the transcendent, on this quest for the other, some artists did think that irony and humor and sort of rebellion against ordinary concepts were the place to go. This particular one, however, was very influenced by the writings of a Frenchman named Breton, particularly a book he wrote called about surrealism. It was the Surrealist Manifesto. Surrealism was very committed to Freudian psychology, so there's a lot of implications of desire, fear of falling, all that sort of stuff, but that the mind translate those into dreams of things that seem completely absurd. But if you know the key, you can explain the dream, and then you can help the person. This one is a religious painting. And absurdly, he takes a spoon and stretches it out. But you can think of all kinds of things here that you might be suggesting. How do you take your religion in small spoonfuls? Is there something good at the end that you can't see? Is there heaven after all, but the only thing the mind knows is desire and palpable things? Who knows? I'm sure he didn't know himself. He painted this stuff as suggestions. But we're on this quest for the other, and we do it by questioning reality. This amazing painter not only painted about a messing with reality at the one level in order to find the deeper spiritual reality at the other level, but he painted automatically. In other words, he believed that his hand and his brush were guided by an occult spirit. So he says, some of modern art tried to get at this other reality by toying with the occult. I mean, we've had sex, we've had African masks, we've had Freudian dreams. Why not actually let your hand be guided, so he believed? And it gave him fish magic. Now, it's meant to be partly humorous and delightful and fun, and but it's also meant to be a kind of the aquarium of the mind. And to take you out of this reality into another one. There's an element of rebellion, of revolt, of anarchy, but it's still through the convention of painting. So they're taking you, you know, you go to a museum, you say, ah, I'm going to go to a museum, I'm going to see something really nice. And what do you see? You see this stuff. So he's got you trapped. And you're either going to say, ah, I hate it, it's bad, and that's, he would love you to do that, because then you're saying, I'm a bourgeois, I won't go in with this stuff, which is looking for the truth. And he would call you just a bourgeois. Or you're totally fascinated and intrigued, but then you flow with the movement and go against the bourgeoisie, and that commits you to rebellion. Another answer, very sad man who, as some of these did, began in a reformed family, was destined for the pastoral ministry, had a crisis, came to the conclusion that reality is only in our minds. Our minds have made things beautiful and symmetrical and harmonious and colorful, but the basics aren't like that at all, and we need to understand that. What are the basics? Here it is. What are they? It's an interesting painting, actually. What's he doing here with our tendency to make things nice? Obviously, this kind of painting would not make any sense outside of the context of the flow of the history of art. So he's obviously making statements about previous artists as well as things he wants us to see. I mean, that's one of the reasons that some modern art is so strange to us, because we look at it out of the context of criticizing or reacting to previous generations of artists. Well, it's in a way very simple. There's only right angles and primary colors. He's got two of them here. The rest is white. And though the reproduction doesn't do this terribly, terribly well, there's no frame on the painting. Francis Schaeffer tells the story about his going to a museum somewhere in Switzerland, and there was an exhibit of Piet Mondrian's work, and the museum had put frames around it. And so, in typical style, he goes to the poor museum director and says, you've done something terrible here. He would have been rolling over in his grave. Take those frames off. The guy probably thought this was a nutcase. But the reason for no frames is because Mondrian believes that a painting is nothing more than an arbitrary point of reality, but it's part of the whole. So everything's a painting. He just is doing us the service of showing us some central parts. And so don't frame it as though it was something special, as though it was something different. It'd be like a musician saying, don't dress up in a coat and tie and go to my concert and clap. All my music is a slice and of the music of everywhere. Paintings don't have titles. They're called compositions, primary colors, right angles. Not surprisingly, he died in complete despair, as did Rothko and Pollock. Many of them were suicidal, and it wasn't just because they had psychological or emotional problems. It was because their quest could not find that transcendence that we saw in the frame diagram. There are wonderful exceptions to the major trend in minor trends. And this is both a call to show the richness of art history, that it's not just monolithically downhill, and for Christians who have a sense of being called into the arts to go and use the techniques and tools that are offered to them, but do it more redemptively. There's a movement in art that was early known as Expressionism, which really picked up on Rembrandt and those wonderful psychological relations and the lighting and so forth, but did something a little more redemptive with it. Compare that to the rebelliousness of an Andy Warhol who painted over and over and over again these iconic pictures, and yet who was not unreligious himself, painted Marilyn Monroe the diptych, which is a religious term for the type of altar. And there she is, plastered 100,000 times on an altar. Or compared to Giacometti, who wrestles with transcendence literally by stretching his figures to reach up to the heavens. Very complex man, very involved with a certain type of Catholicism, trying to guide you to look upward. Stanley Spencer, more of a collage, almost Art Deco, but really going back to the Dante, and yet it's very modern, wonderful, thoughtful procession of Christ to his passion, where you're drawn in. The painting has a sort of circular feeling. You're drawn in to follow Christ, and you may carry his burdens, but Christ will be carrying yours. So there's some great counter trends to some of these. We can have the lights now, thank you. These more declinist views. Now, this is a very rapid way of showing some of the trends in modern art, but my point is very simple. If we want to understand contemporary culture and do apologetics in relationship to what people are living and thinking and how they're moving and how their hearts are, there are many useful ways to do it. One of them is to see how its most articulate painters have actually visualized for us that contradiction, but that parallel, that opposition, rebellion, but the functional parallels or parasites. Not surprisingly, there it is in a visual form. As Francis Schaeffer says, one of the best places to do evangelism is in an art gallery. And now, of course, you have to kind of be Francis Schaeffer to be able to look at a painting and say, okay, here's what it means. But you know, each of us has a specialty. Each of us has areas that we are interested in, love. You don't have to leave your cultural area in order to do sort of magic words that you've learned in a book that are supposed to help people find faith. Cornelius Van Til once made the point that you can begin anywhere in your gospel presentation, because nothing is without its revelatory value. In a lot of traditional apologetics, you kind of have to get somebody on your railroad tracks, get them on the train, get them to, you know, first admit that they exist, and then the reason can accept there's a God, and then you can begin to move the train along and say, but I've got good news for you. In presuppositional apologetics, you don't have to do that. You can begin anywhere, because everything is an evidence of something about the presence and the demands of God. So the next couple of times, I'm going to lay this out more in lecture form and give us some trends and some philosophical notions about where we are. But I'll do a couple more illustrations just to show you that this is not simply mind stuff or rational 10-point arguments, but this is where people are. They live and move and have their being. So we'll be exploring the way that goes, and hope that you'll begin to look around to see that these trends are not just in specialty areas like philosophy or whatever, but they're just everywhere. Thanks. Have a good weekend.